signal out there, thinks it's looking at a full halfway dipole, except for the fact that the signal's a little bit stronger, because by conservation of energy with an infinite shape, you're no longer radiating energy into the lower hemisphere. You're only radiating the energy in the upper hemisphere, if and only if the sheet of metal is infinite. Okay, now you and I are deciding to set up a vertical ground plane antenna in our backyard. And if this is the best of all worlds, when it drops, you'd have an infinite sheet of metal. You and I, well, you do, but I don't have the resources to do all that. So I'm going to lay down some number of ground plane radials. And now I'm laying down enough ground plane radials to make sure that the spacing between the radials, particularly in close where the field around the antenna is strong, I want the spacing to be between the radials to be so small compared to the wavelength that very little of the RF energy can squeeze between those radials and see the Earth. Because any RF energy that sees the Earth looks at it as a dummy bone. It's a distributed volumetric resistor. The RF energy that hits the ground, particularly moist ground, will get absorbed, turned into heat, doesn't get radiated in space, and it's wasteful. The guy out in the Mojave Desert where he mounts his antenna on very, very dry sand, he doesn't have that problem. Very, very dry sand is nowhere near as absorptive. Very few people have that luxury. For the rest of us, we got to lay down enough ground plane radials so that we don't see Earth. If you're mounting the antenna a half wavelength or so above the ground, now the RF energy that goes between the radials can't see the Earth very easily. And instead of laying down 35 radials, you can lay down 3 or 4 and get full performance if your antenna is high enough in the ground, high enough above the ground, that it doesn't see the Earth. The RF energy doesn't see the Earth. Now, 3 or 4 radials will give you the same performance, gain-wise. With those radials straight out, let's make 3 or 4 of them, you'll have something a little bit higher than 35 ohm impedance with a normal quarter-wave radiator. As I start tilting those 3 or 4 radials downward, let's go to the extreme. I tilt them further and further down. Eventually, I tilt them down 90 degrees. I've now made the other half of the dipole. My impedance now became 73 ohms. Out flat, impedance is close to 35 ohms. Down all the way vertical, 73 ohms. At around a 45 degree angle, it hit the 50 ohm point. So I could make a quarter wave radiator with the radials down at about a 45 degree angle, 3 or 4 of them, and added something close to 50 ohm of impedance. I only can get away with that if the antenna is far above the ground so that it doesn't see Earth and give me this lossy phenomenon. Now, depending on the way I design the antenna, I could have it set up in such a way that I'm connecting the coax cable to the centerpiece of tubing, so to speak, which maybe has a telescoping section inside, so that the feed point is not really being fed right at the connector where I'm screwing in my cable, but it's really being fed some distance above that inside of the radome, where now I could have my radiators up above in the normal manner, and a quarter wavelength or a half wavelength of radiator down below the feed point in the vicinity of where the coax cable goes in. So you don't have to have 3 or 4 ground plane radials. I can have another telescoping piece of tubing that goes around the coax cable that goes into it, and that is the counterpoise. Now, what the word counterpoise means is where is the reservoir of electrons? Let me explain that one. If your feed line is doing a really good job, it makes the antenna a full halfway dipole think that the transmitter is a tiny little device right at the center of the dipole. If your feed line is really hooked up right, the antenna can't tell the difference of it being a tiny high-power transmitter right across the egg insulator in the center, or really is a lossless piece of transmission line and the transmitter is really half a mile away. The antenna can't tell the difference. But in the case of a half-wave dipole, your transmitter is a pump of electrons. On the first half cycle, it is grabbing electrons from the left side of the dipole and pumping them into the right side. On the second half cycle, it's doing the opposite, pumping them from the right to the left. The electrons don't get radiated into space, but the current caused by pumping the electrons left and right creates the magnetic field that gets radiated. The electrons themselves don't jump off the antenna. And those electrons, the energy of one pulse of those electrons, one whole half cycle, if I track just that energy of that half cycle, you'll find that that particular chunk of energy, that particular number of joules, has to bounce back and forth on the antenna on a full half-wave dipole something like 20 times before it finally gets radiated in space. Make the dipole super short and find ways of electronically lengthening it, like loading coils and top hat capacitors and meandering. Now you have less length that's doing the creation of the magnetic field by the current that's flowing. You don't make as much of a field as easily. Therefore, you don't dissipate the energy into space as easily. And now the energy doesn't have to bounce back and forth 20 times. It's got to bounce back 40 times, so to speak. It's got higher Q. The antenna is more narrowband. Do anything to physically make the antenna smaller than full half wave, and it will increase in Q and become more narrowband. Let me drop. So now, in the case of a full half wave dipole, the left-hand side of the dipole is the counterpoise when I'm pumping electrons from it into the right-hand side, and vice versa. When I build a ground plane with those three little radials, I am on one half cycle pumping current out of those three little radials into the antenna, and the other half cycle, I'm pumping it back. Counterpoise is, you could call it the reserve or the reservoir of electrons. You have to stand somewhere to do the action. Very similar to what happens with my little example of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Assume he's 200 pounds. He's floating in the cargo hold of the space shuttle. He's got a 200-pound barbell in his hand. He pushes the barbell 10 feet per second to the north. He goes 10 feet per second to the south. Action and reaction. Newton's third law. Well, the same thing happens with pumping electrons. You're pumping them from the counterpoise into the antenna and back into the counterpoise. There's got to be a counterpoise somewhere. Without it, your feed line becomes the counterpoise, so to speak, and the outside of your coax cable starts launching a whole lot of current, and you get the RF in the shack and some other disadvantages. So I think this gives you a little bit more of a feeling of what those radials are doing, why they're at crazy angles, why you don't have to have 35 of them on a station master antenna. If a station master antenna was going to be mounted on the ground in your backyard, without 35 radials, you'd be wasting half your power into that dirt. W-A-2-C-D-L, K-2-R-I-W on the TechNet.
And how do you listen?
RSO with a quick question. RSO recognized, and another station will pick you up in a minute. Andy, CDL first.
Okay, very good. Let me just make sure I'm not doubling. I'm not, okay. All right, very good. That's a very clear explanation, and from what I read in the past, yes, it definitely affects the impedance, because I remember reading that, of the antenna. Now, I'm going to try an experiment, because I happen to have a diamond tri-band antenna, which is set up for 2 meters, 440, and 1296, and it has three straight radials on the bottom of the antenna that screw into the bottom. And the radials, the ground radials, I guess they're about a foot long or so, approximately, and they go straight out. They don't droop. There's no angle. They are perfectly horizontal to the ground when the antenna is mounted. And yes, the antenna will be pretty high up. It will be on the top of the tower. And just for some experimentation, I'm going to remove those ground radials, which could be done very easily, and I'm going to measure the impedance of the antenna with the antenna mounted on a mast, let's say 20 feet off the ground or so. And with my MFJ antenna analyzer, I could easily see what the impedance is, and I'm going to put the radials back on, and I want to see how much that changes. I'm just curious. But regarding station masters, again, because I've seen some with these ground radials and some without ground radials, I've even seen a few installations where the ground radials were damaged. There was one that was missing completely. It was hit. And I'm not even sure if the customer even knew about it. Just wanted to get your answer on that. So let me give it to the other stations because I'm sure there's more information to be had. Dick, thank you. Back to you.
Yeah, one of the things you should know about a station master, Andy, whenever you remove that radome and really look inside, you'll see, I think it's a quarter-inch diameter, semi-rigid coax cable, copper outer conductor. They don't bother silver plating it. And you'll see three, four, or five sections of semi-rigid cable that are a half wavelength long, and they crisscross between center conductor and shield, and they're all collinear, by the way. They crisscross between the various sections, center conductor and shield. So each individual section is fed out of phase with the adjacent section. So the majority of the radiation is taking place by those multiple half-wavelength dipoles that are all cascaded together in a collinear manner. And you're feeding the middle of one of the bottom ones of those. As such, in this particular case, the radials on the bottom are not so much the counterpoise, but they're an RF choke. You're trying to stop the current that flows down the support structure of the antenna from continuing down the rest of the coax cable. In other words, because there's a bunch of half-wave, full half-wave dipoles stacked together within the radiator section of the antenna itself, it really has 90% of its own counterpoise internally. And those ground plane radials sticking out the side are primarily a kind of an RF choke. So when you remove them, I predict you're going to see not a huge change in impedance, but if you had one of these snipping devices where you could measure the current, RF current, at the operating frequency flowing down the outside of the coax cable, I'm relatively sure you would definitely see an increase in that current when you remove those radials, because now they're more of a choke than they are a counterpoise. That's a bunch of opinions on what I know about those. I tried building those antennas at UHF frequencies. Impedance matching them is very tough. Now, Frank has some questions on this one. N2RSO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, I think you answered my question, which is those three drooping radials, wouldn't they work as a decoupling device, which is basically what you said, to remove the RF off the shield of the coax. I'm reminded of the old AEA isopole antennas. If you recall, they had two cones which made the antenna resemble a jousting lance from days of Camelot. And the purpose of those, was my understanding, that was for decoupling only.
Yeah, 90% of that action, I think, was decoupling, just like you said. As you make the radiator conic in shape, larger in diameter, as you do anything to make it more substantial, the antenna becomes more broadband, the antenna becomes more definable in resistive component and reactive component. If you pick up any one of the copies of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, I think it was 1972, the first one by Jasek in Chapter 3, all other editions, edition number 2, 3, and 4, is in Chapter 4. You'll find a set of curves by Brown and Woodward. This was a lot of work that was done in 1945-46 time frame. Brown and Woodward, working for, I think it was the Sinclair Antenna Company, spent probably a man year. And when you read the original article, go back to the original article, which was brought into my hand this very week, really, they describe how they did that set of curves that are in Chapter 3 and the first edition, Chapter 4 of all others. These curves I'm talking about, you see a set of curves for a monopole antenna on an infinite ground plane. For every possible diameter that you and I can imagine, they plot what is the resistive component on one curve, one graph, and the other graph they plot the reactive component. And there's not just one line on the graph, there's 10 or 15 lines on the graph for all possible diameters of the radiator. What's unique about those curves, and the original article makes it more clear than the write-up that goes within the Antenna Engineering Handbook. Let me drop. The unique thing about those curves, and Brown and Woodward said this, and that is once you have an infinite sheet of metal and monopole antenna, and you measure all possible impedances for all possible diameters, all possible frequencies, they did it by sweeping the frequencies, so to speak, but plotting what the antenna looked like when the antenna was 10 degrees long, 90 degrees long, 180 degrees long. 90 degrees long means it's quarter wave long. 180 degrees long means it's half wave long, and so on. So the way, it's a unique way of measuring it. In other words, they tell you degrees length of antenna. That way the horizontal axis plotted in degrees is really frequency, but you can write in the frequency yourself on your particular favorite band. If the center of the curve horizontally is at 90 degrees, and that's the frequency where your antenna is quarter wavelength long, then you can easily write in those frequencies for the way you're using it. So it's a kind of frequency independent, even though the curve represents swept frequency response. So all possible diameters are there, you could say, for all possible lengths. And because in those days they didn't have a modern-day network analyzer and a computer, they were doing it the hard way with a slotted line and a slide rule and a lot of paper manual calculations. And there's only 40 ways you can go wrong when you do that. If you ever really done impedance confirmation or impedance measurement by way of a Smith chart, by way of a slotted line, and putting shorts and opens and other things on the slotted line to calibrate it, it's a very tedious process. Represents a lot of work. But now, once you realize that a monopole is half of a dipole, so whatever impedance you get off of that chart, the resistive chart gives you the resistive component, the reactive chart gives you the reactive component, plus and minus, meaning inductive and capacitive. Now, whatever number the chart tells you, if you're doing it in a dipole manner instead of a monopole manner, because of the symmetry between those two antennas, you just simply double whatever you read off that chart. If it tells you your antenna is 41 ohms as a monopole, you know that that exact mechanical configuration is going to give you 82 ohms as a dipole. Very handy set of curves. In the last 5 years, as a consultant, using those curves almost every day, other day of my life, in my opinion, I've earned a small fortune. That is to say, I've designed a whole lot of antennas, short, long, compact, meandered, inductively loaded, capacitively loaded, whatever. And I use that set of curves to predict what performance I'm going to get ahead of time, what bandwidth I'm going to get ahead of time, what impedance matching network is going to be required. And it didn't get me exactly to home plate, but those curves got me well inside the ballpark. Those curves got me well inside the ballpark on every occasion. Those curves allowed me to see certain relationships between swept frequency, diameters, and whatever. Because I saw those relationships and made variations of the various kinds of antennas, I was able to make seemingly new antennas, and now my name is on a whole bunch of patent applications. Some of them have already been issued. You just look up my name at the U.S. Patent Office, and you'll see some interesting antennas. I'm now writing the patent on antenna number either 16 or number 17, and those curves are some of the starting points. Now, in that same chapter of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, you'll see that those set of curves I just mentioned, Brown and Woodward, are for constant diameter antennas of various diameters, dipole or monopole-like antennas. And another page or two downrange, again by Brown and Woodward, you'll see a set of curves where you now don't make the radiating section constant in diameter, but you make it tapered, either as a cone that gets wider or a cone that gets more narrow at the tips. And again, you get broadbanding and some interesting impedance characteristics when you do that. One of the things that I've discovered recently from the Brown and Woodward constant diameter curves is that the very bottom of the curves, where the antenna gets extremely thick, the bandwidth gets extremely wide, and very few people have gone there. And recently I've worked on an antenna where I made out of sheets of copper, because I'm doing it not at 80 meters, you know, where the antenna would be 135 feet long, 132 feet long. I'm doing it up at 1,000 megacycles, where the antenna only has to be something like 11 inches long to be half wave. Oh, that's full wave. Half wave is 5.5 inches or so. and you make it out of very wide pieces of copper and curve them into very interesting shapes, you now get antennas that are so broadband that you can work on multiple bands simultaneously, continuously. You don't have to build a broadband antenna as a log periodic. There are ways you can get extreme bandwidth out of using wide chunks of copper. The very first patent I filed about 4 years ago, maybe it was 4.5 years ago, is literally taking a Yagi-like structure and making the elements super wide. And when you do that, you can get extremely low standing wave ratio across a very broad bandwidth. Everyone thinks a Yagi is a narrow band antenna. You make the elements broad enough and couple them together just right, and you're doing this on a Smith chart, you can get extremely, a Smith chart presentation on a network analyzer, you can get extreme bandwidth with very low VSWR. I'm talking about numbers like 1.05 to 1 standing wave ratio across the 3% bandwidth. There's a lot of value in that for certain
repeaters. Timeout, cancel.
There's a lot of value in that for certain kinds of modern-day electronics. A modern-day RFID reader, for instance, really is a kind of a CW radar. And if you're building the kind that runs on one antenna, where you're transmitting and receiving simultaneously, you really want to make sure your standing wave ratio of your antenna is very low, because whatever you're transmitting into that antenna, all the reflected energy due to standing wave ratio is going to come back and jam your receiver. Yeah, therefore, your receiver will be desensitized. So if you can get extremely low VSWR of the antenna, you can transmit and receive from it simultaneously on the same frequency. Hard to believe that you can do that with modern-day electronics. And when you build these antennas that are super wide, you suddenly discover that the normal modeling techniques do not work. There's a $50,000 program that people think is the cat's meow called HFSS, High Frequency Structure Simulator. Very expensive program. You put these super wide antennas into that program, and it has a lot of trouble modeling them, because by finite element analysis, it's trying to take your conductor, break it down into a whole bunch of little bitty triangles, analyze what current voltage is across every one of those triangles, and because you've got such a large number of triangles, the program essentially bombs and says, hey, I can't handle all that. I'll give you an approximate answer, but I ain't going to tell you the truth. So therefore, we have discovered by empirical techniques how to make super wide antennas in ways that you can't do by modeling. It takes experience knowing how to build antennas, how to build them wideband, and you may not find it by modeling. Now, I think this is a temporary condition. I think the modeling people are eventually going to catch on that there's a need for this, and they're going to boost up the program in some way. But that's probably going to take a couple of years before that happens. That's a bunch of opinions. Anyone with any further questions or comments, give me a call, let us right now. K2LAW in the TechNet.
RSO.
Frank recognized. Anyone else? You got it, Frank.
Dick, it sounds to me like one of your patented antennas would be very effective for New Star users in the 1200 megacycle range.
Yeah, one of the good pieces of news, Frank, is that I strongly believe, and not everyone will agree with me on this one, I strongly believe that take any antenna that works well on any frequency, and if you scale every single dimension of the antenna proportional to 1 over frequency, the new antenna on the new frequency will do exactly the same thing. So antennas, in my opinion, scale. I've had some arguments with some people on that exact subject recently, and not everyone agrees with me, but I think a good number of antenna engineers will. So where I'm designing 1,000 mega antennas, and you want a 1296 version, have at it. And if you just simply scale it, in other words, because you're increasing things by 20% more in frequency, you decrease it 20% in size, and you should get the exact same performance. So take some of these patented antennas and build the 1296 version. You should have a grand old time with them. Now, in the case of the service you're talking about, do you desire to transmit and receive simultaneously on essentially the same frequency, in which case you have a strong need for very low standing wave ratio? I have worked on antennas where the reflected power from the antenna was minus 40 dB while it is transmitting. That's probably something like a 1.03 standing wave ratio across a significant band of frequencies. In the past, you give a specification like that to an antenna manufacturer, and they say, get the heck out of here, you guys are crazy. Because up until now, all antennas were set for, let me drop, a particular standing wave ratio in order to have a particular transmitting efficiency. Everybody builds an antenna to a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. At the frequency where the antenna hits 2.0-to-1, you have 89% efficiency on the first pass. In other words, of the energy you send down the antenna, 89% of it gets sent into space, 11% gets reflected back toward the transmitter. And with an antenna tuner, you can correct that, but on the first pass, 89%, 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. If you tune the antenna for a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio, you've got 96% efficiency. If you ask an antenna manufacturer for 30 dB reflection coefficient, I think it's 1.06 or something like that, standing wave ratio, he thinks you're asking for 99.91% efficiency. He says that's way beyond the law of diminishing return. You're crazy. Get out of here. No bid. He doesn't realize you're not doing it for efficiency reasons. You're doing it to save your own receiver. So in the service you're advocating there, Frank, I wonder if you're trying to receive and transmit simultaneously on the same antenna. If so, this new class of antennas that I've been inventing, so to speak, me and my buddies, I'm co-inventor in almost all of these things, we have what you need. N2RSO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, at first I was a little confused. I thought you meant working full duplex operations, similar to a cell phone. I don't believe D-Star is set up for that yet, anyway, probably in the future. But if you mean to use, you know, the same antenna, especially on a D-Star repeater for both transmit and receive, yeah, that would be very logical.
Now, let me show you how we got into this. The vast majority of RFID, radio frequency identification tag reading systems, the vast majority of them have two side-by-side antennas. You transmit on one antenna, you receive out of the other. The reason you have to do that is the way the RFID tag works is that it is a one-frequency system. If you're transmitting to the tag at 915 megacycles at this instant, and the FCC rules make you hop every millisecond or so to a new frequency, so you're spreading your spectrum. But during the time you're sitting on 915 megacycles and you're transmitting 915, the tag receives that energy, rectifies some of it. The rectified energy charges a capacitor. The capacitor becomes a temporary battery. The battery runs the integrated circuit chip. The integrated circuit chip reads the message you have transmitted to it, which is called the addressing message. And if the addressing message was, okay, all tags talk to me now, or the address message could be, only the tags where the serial number begins with A talk to me now, or only the tags that have A and a 1 talk to me now. So you address the tag, you've woken up the tag with RF energy, you address the tag, he says, aha, he's talking to me, and the tag then spits back a 96-bit code, which is all the information that you've stored in that tag. It could be a serial number, it could be the date it was manufactured, it could be the fact that it's connected to a bottle of Cheerios, and the Cheerios was manufactured on March 14, 2008. That could be the message, 96 bits of message. It spits the message back to you on the exact same frequency you're sending. It does that by modulating the impedance of its little dipole antenna. So it's spitting back the message by connecting a low impedance and a high impedance, but that's the way it's doing it. It can be either an amplitude modulation or an angular modulation, but however the tag decides to modulate, he's modulating the signal you're sending to him. Because he's modulating, he's making an upper and lower sideband. If he's modulating at 100 kc rate and turning it on and off with Morse code, so to speak, that's the bits of information, your receiver has to listen to that upper and lower sideband with the exact same carrier frequency. Your receiver is a zero IF receiver. Let me drop. Looking for that upper and lower sideband. Very sophisticated system. Extremely simple in the electronics that's on the tag, and a little bit on the sophisticated side when it comes to the reader. So the vast majority of readers transmit with one antenna, receive on the other antenna, because that's the only way you can get enough isolation between the antennas so that the transmitter doesn't jam your own receiver. It's on the exact same frequency. You cannot filter out that frequency. The spacing is too close. The upper and lower sideband is 100 kc away at 915 megacycles. You'd need a queue of 500,000 to have enough selectivity to listen to only the sideband without hearing the carrier, if you know what I mean. So you have to have a receiver that can tolerate that echo that it gets from that receiving antenna. So for a bunch of reasons to get that isolation, the vast majority of readers up till now have been a dual antenna reader, transmitting antenna, receiving antenna. All of a sudden, a bunch of customers say, I haven't got that much real estate. Can't you give me a smaller antenna? And a few smart companies have said, yeah, we can do that. We can transmit and receive into the same antenna, as long as you allow us to build the antenna just right. And you build the antenna with an extremely low standing wave ratio, now you can do that. And so all of a sudden, there's a need for extremely low standing wave ratio antennas, which has nothing to do with the previous 100 years of experience with antennas. Standing wave ratio before was only done to make sure your transmitter is happy and doesn't go into the self-protect mode and make sure you get transmitting efficiency. Here you're not doing it for efficiency. You're not trying to get 99.99% way the line beyond the law of diminishing returns. Wonder if some of that makes some sense, Frank. Now you see why there's a need for a brand new class of antennas, KQRIW in the DECNET.
Yeah, Dick, it sounds very logical. As a matter of fact, it sounds much like the way the E-Command system works, am I correct?
Yeah, I should let you know that there's a drastic staticky noise, like you've got a loose antenna connection there or a loose microphone connection there, Frank. Yes, EasyPass is identical to what I'm talking about. EasyPass is an RFID tag, but that is a semi-active. The EasyPass contains a battery. The good news about the battery is that it makes the receiver on the tag extremely sensitive. Whereas on a thoroughly passive tag, the tag only wakes up when you give it enough RF energy that it's able to rectify it and make a temporary battery out of its capacitor. It takes a lot more power to do that. The EasyPass has, I'm going to pick a number, 5 times or 10 times more range because it's got a battery for its receiver. The receiver is always active, you could say. He's just sitting there sniffing, waiting until somebody addresses him, and the address is, hey, all tags coming through this particular aisle right now, talk to me, no matter what car you're on, or certain tags to quiet down because I've already read you. You know, that kind of information is being sent in the addressing, the forward link. The reverse link is the tag number, which identifies you, that particular automobile that's going through that particular toll bridge or tunnel or whatever. So EasyPass has a battery. I think the battery is good for something like 5 years because it's a very low drain receiver. But EasyPass is a very sophisticated kind of semi-passive of RFID, radio frequency identification tag. You're going to see more and more of these in the future. At first, people thought that they're going to be heavily competitive with barcodes. They supplement and complement barcodes. Barcodes are definitely always going to be cheaper. A small fraction of a penny is the price of a barcode. That's the good news. But the barcode gives you something like 12 bits of information. An RFID tag can easily give you 96 bits of information. There are sophisticated ones that will give you 256 bits of information, and they can be rewritten. You can put a tag on your package that's being shipped from Singapore, and it goes to 3 or 4 other ports, and it goes into each one of those ports. You write more information into the tag, and now when the tag arrives in New York port, it's now got the whole history of what hour it arrived at each one of those other ports, and you can read all that information. They are rewritable. I'm talking about thoroughly passive little tags where the tag itself is about 3 or 4 inches long in one particular version, the smaller one, and the actual integrated circuit chip that's doing all that work. You almost cannot see it with the naked eye. You have to look at it under a microscope. It's about 20,000ths of an inch little black cube that's doing all that. Micro-miniature electronics is here, Frank, at 2RSO, K2RIW. I can tell that you probably wiggled your mic lead, Frank. Once I realized what was going on, I plugged my receiver in a different way and listened to your audio. Your audio is less than 1% of normal volume. Very, very, very low audio volume at this time. And as I went to a different receiving mode, I was able to hear what you said for the second two-thirds. And you were talking about a thunderstorm going through Staten Island. Maybe that's why Mel is off right now. He may be disconnecting all of his electronics because of the storm. Also, he was up around the clock, and he really should be sleeping. For all I know, his XYL is telling him, hey, you better go easy. I mean, he and I are both retired people. We've got to worry about our health. Let's give a quick call for Mel and see if he's there. K2KEY, K2LIW.
And it is K2KEY. Yeah, I'm trying to put things together here. And last minute I had stuff away, you know, it's getting dark. And I had a whole driveway loaded with stuff. Dropped off, the generator was dropped off by one of our members. I had to get that in the garage and a number of other things that, you know, I can't possibly take a chance of leaving out. So I am, as I say, feel like I've been through the ringer. I've been on the go since yesterday morning, earliest, 7:30 in the morning we started. And so I think it's caught up with me, Dick. So I think I'll just, we'll leave the mail go for this week because I didn't even bother even looking at it over.
Perfectly understandable. As the president of the Kings County Radio Club in this great big operation that Floyd Bennett Field for Field Day, keeping all those guys happy, making sure they got enough food, food, drink, radios, microphones, transmitters, antennas, feed lines, gasoline, generators, all of that jazz. Hey, you've been a busy fella. So we'll skip the mailbag tonight. We maybe will have, depending on how many other questions we have from either Joe, RYY, or Frank, RSO, and Andy, CDO, and Bill, CUK. These are the guys who are asking questions tonight. Slightly unusual group. Depending on what we've got, we'll either stop early or we'll go on to other subjects. So we'll skip the mailbag tonight. And if you want to get some shut-eye, I think you should. You're not a young man anymore. Let me think now. One of us is a couple of days older than the other. You're a couple of days older than me. I was born at the end of the month in February. I think you were born in the middle of the month of February. Isn't that true, Frank? You're older than me. You should know better.
And the old man, very nice. Thank you very much. Well, let me put it to you this way. I did a lot of climbing, that's for sure. I was up and down, you know. Get the dipoles up there. It takes a lot of, a lot of hands, I should say. It's still a big project to really string good antennas. And, you know, we have the facility there. It's there. It just takes the effort to, you know, utilize it. So we put up the beams, you know, for 6 meters. We had the beam, the tri-band beam up there. And, of course, the 80-meter dipole stretched from the top of the tower up there out to a lamppost hundreds of feet out. And the same thing with a 40-meter dipole. And then, like you say, it's with the generator, the outlet, the variac. I have to drag these variacs because all each operating position, I have to put a variac because the generator puts out too much voltage, Dick, over.
That's very smart that you run variacs. Yeah, I think many a generator puts out 136 volts knowing that there's going to be a significant line drop between it and the final load. Very few generators connect the load, you know, 1 foot away. It's usually on the other foot, on the other end of 100 foot of extension cord. In your particular case, I'll bet some of your extension cords, even though they're a heavy gauge, are probably even longer than 100 feet. Is that true, Frank? I keep calling you Frank. Sorry about that. Mel?
It's okay. As long as you don't call me late for dinner, I think they... No, really, yeah, the problem is, we have... extension cord is a good long one, no doubt. It's heavy. It's a heavy extension cord with number 10 wire. And on a reel, that's quite a heavy thing. And the generator is basically, when I spoke to them with a donation, it's generators at a club. And I wound up, when I got it, I had to, you know, do a lot of work on it to get it fixed up. And I noticed the voltage was kind of high, close to 140, as you said. So I called up Coleman to make the generator. And he said, well, it's not a specifically designed generator for electronic applications of any sort. It's designed for use in, for workmen using saws and drills and, you know, and hammer drills and things of that sort. It was not really... now, however, there are some real nice generators. You may have seen the QST with some really nice portable generators that are ideal for these applications like field day pickover.
All right,
sir.
Now you sound good, Frank. Go ahead, Frank.
I switched my... probably the problem is I was using a HiO mic that was really designed for ICOM HF operations. So, a little annoying, as they say. Okay, to follow up on Mel's thought, we were very lucky to obtain a Honda 2-kilowatt generator using inverter technology. And it works very well with electronic devices because of that inverter technology.
Yeah, I think an awful lot of the modern-day alternators, motor generator sets, are alternator types. In other words, slip rings with low current going into a rotary field, and the stator windings are what give you the real output power. I wonder if your generator is running that way, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Oh, this generator we have is a, basically, is just a... it's a, you know, a one chunk there that's a bridge and track, 10 horsepower engine driving the alternator. And, you know, it's not quiet like the new stuff. You can't operate, you know, a station, an amateur radio set up nearby because it does make a bit of noise. I tried, I throttled it back because it's 5 kW and it says, we didn't really need that much power. Like, we run three stations, 300 watt, 100 watt rig, some other stuff, odds and ends. So I tried to, you know, economize it. I throttled it back somewhat, adjusted it up, and so it really gives us, yeah, it gives us good gas economy. We use in 24 hour period, we use about, maybe about 7 gallons of gas, so can't complain about how much gasoline it is. The problem is, like I say, weight, the DB noise level is somewhat high. And so it's basically nothing like what is now available, such as Honda puts out, Dick, over.
Dick, I think the basic difference with the inverter, the Honda, is the difference between having a square wave and a sine wave.
So when you say inverter, do you really mean electronic inverter, in other words, switching transistors, as opposed to a rotary machine? I think you're saying that you've got a DC generator feeding an electronic alternator, electronic inverter. Is that what you're saying, Frank?
I believe this is so.
Hmm. Interesting. I'm not sure there's an advantage in that. There are certain disadvantages. And by the way, most of the modern-day transistorized inverters are doing it with a double-step square wave. There's an inner step and an outer step, so to speak, to try to come close to a sine wave. A pure square wave will make ordinary rectified power supplies a little bit unhappy because a pure sine wave of 120 volts RMS hits 167 volts peak, whereas a square wave, a perfect square wave of 120 volts, only goes to 120 volts. So if you've got a diode capacitor rectifier system looking for that 167 volt peak and it only gets 120 volts at peak, in the case of a television set, you'll get a picture that's not as wide as normal and everything's running on low voltage. So they've gotten around that problem by having another square pulse in the middle of the main square pulse that goes to 167 for a brief period of time. I think they call it dual step or something like that. So it really is kind of two inverters built into one, and the voltages get summed. So a brief inverter and a full square wave inverter is one way of looking at it. And so that, as opposed to a rotary alternator, you still have to have the rotary machinery to make the DC voltage. So I'm not convinced there's an advantage in the more electronic version. Have to do a little more research into that. You've got nice clean audio now, Frank, except that it's about 50% of the volume. Good and clean, but 50%, whereas when you had that microphone failure, you were down below 1%. I had to do some special things there to get the audio out, if you know what I mean. Now, of all the people who are present, is there any other subject that anyone wants to discuss tonight? Looks like we're not going to go to the mailbag tonight. Mel's going to be getting some shut-eye a little bit earlier. Anyone else want to discuss any subject? Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW listening.
K2KY, one more thing.
Mel.
UB2EAB, the idea.
Mel recognized and Ed in that order. Mel first.
Okay, well, like I said, I didn't get a chance to take anything off the machine. That's basically, you know, not the idea. I have to get shut-eye earlier. The concept I've just talked about of using this inverter principle seems to be the way that they are going with all these portable types of electronic generating plants that they are selling now, very compact units, very easily to carry, one person to carry them. I was talking with a visitor that we had, KC2QRQ, and his job is basically he's designing power supplies, and he's telling us about, he was telling us all about power supplies that he is, they, his company is building, from small power supplies up to humongous things that run whole buildings, like the hospital, their backup system. And it seems like they're doing it the same way. They're building huge switching power supplies, that motor generated switching power supplies. And this is the method that they use for controlling the situation by the switching method. Basically, you can say it's a type of inverter, over.
How about that? Alrighty. And these modern-day inverters are very good at self-protecting. I've got a number of these uninterruptible power supplies around the house running certain pieces of electronics, and I think that's the way they work. Let's see what Ed's got to say. Ed, I think you're running on a handy-talkie. Occasionally, you have a little bit of noise, but I'm pretty sure we'll get your message. Mr. EAV, K2RIW.
Thank you,
Paul
Crickey, W2EWK.
Stand by, Eugene. Mel for, I mean, Eugene, stand by. Ed first. Go ahead, Ed.
Should I wait for him?
No, I turned it over to you, Ed. Go ahead.
All right, I'm saying based on nothing except work. Is that a generator, they have a gasoline engine running, say, a truck alternator, so supposedly, because they make them by the million, they're cheap, and then a C to clean 150-volt AC, electronic switching alternator on that. The advantage of that is you use readily available components that might be cheaper, and you move the onus of the regulation of voltage, frequency, wave shape onto some electronics. These days it's a lot easier to control through some kind of servo mechanism. Just an idea.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and I can see why. Talk to any of the guys who do mountain tapping operations on, say, 10 gigahertz, and they're running on a portable generator, and they're trying to run a traveling wave tube power supply and traveling wave tube. 95% of them will be complaining about the fact that the spike coming out of the rotary signal rotary power generator, those spikes will false alarm the detecting circuitry that's in the power supply of the traveling wave tube. It thinks that a arc has been initiated in the tube, and the power supply goes into the standby mode, goes into the self-protect mode. It keeps flipping over that way. And almost no one has found a way of using the right kind of a power conditioner to avoid that problem. What you're describing is a beautiful solution. Let the generator, with all of its spikes, it may be very minor, but the circuitry of a TWT power supply is very sensitive. It's trying to look for the initiation of a corona within the tube, and it excites its crowbar circuit to kill all the stored energy on its high-voltage capacitors before the arc gets a chance to really start dumping a significant number of joules into that tube and doing damage. So that self-protect mechanism is always being false alarmed by motor generator sets. And what you're describing is a beautiful way to get around that. And my guess is other chunks of electronics within a hospital are equally sensitive to the spikes that a rotary generator generates. Although a alternator type has a much, much lower amount of current flowing through those slip rings, still it is sliding contacts capable of making interference, which is going to come out with the right kind of instrumentation on the 60 cycle power that comes out. In the case of Mel's generator, where he's getting 140 volts out of it, if he slows down the governor to get it down to, say, 125 volts, now he's probably running on 55 hertz instead of 60. He's making the motor run slower. It was designed at 60 hertz to put out 140 volts into a long power cord, into a skill saw. And the guy running a skill saw, he just wants to make sure the voltage doesn't drop so that the skill saw jams while he's cutting through a 4x4. That's his biggest worry. The fact that he's got higher voltage and the brushes in the skill saw are being burned up a little bit faster, he doesn't care about that. He just wants it to cut through that piece of wood real fast. Anybody with any further comments at all, just give me a call. Oh, maybe not. Here we go.
RSO?
RSO, but the EWK wanted to say something. Eugene, go ahead and right ahead with your comment, Eugene. Okay, maybe Eugene's not there. Frank, you've got it.
Yeah, I think further comments about switching power supplies. I have a new one on order from MFJ, which is a switching power supply that weighs only about 10 pounds that's capable of putting out 70 amps, and it's a perfect match for the MFJ the Meritron half-gallon linear amplifier that they're selling. It's mainly a mobile unit, but that switching power supply makes a very effective home base for those people who need that extra power.
70 amps, probably at 12 volts, which is around 700 watts of capability, more than 700 watts of capability. Fantastic. And that probably is switching something like at 100 kc rate with a real fancy piece of a ferrite in the transformer that's doing all that. A friend of mine has asked me recently which of the ferrites will give you high power capability at 300 megs, 300 megacycles, and that's a real problem. I don't know of a good reference that that gives information along those lines. There is a Q1, Q2, and Q3 ferrite. The Q1, I think, is very high in mu, but only works at low frequencies. The Q3 is very low in Q, but I think it goes to high frequencies. But not very many ferrites can tolerate a high amount of power above 300 megacycles. I wonder if anyone's got any good references on the sources of ferrite and powdered iron that goes to reasonably high power at, say, for instance, 300 megacycles and above. Where do you go to get that kind of information? K2LIW on the TechNet.
K2QIQ with the cover.
Glenn recognized, we've been talking about you.
Hopefully good things, Dick. So take it easy and hi to everyone on the net. A good source for ferrite is magnetic zinc. Also, if you have questions about that, they have quite a few engineers on staff. If you're looking for, you know, they can answer just about all your questions for custom magnetics if they do make them.
Okay, magneticsinc.com, is that approximately their website? Or just Google Magnetics Inc. And I think you're saying not only do they make power for inverters, you know, 100 KC type switching regulators, but they also make ferrites and powdered irons that go to many watts of power at 300 megacycles and above, to your knowledge, Glenn, go ahead.
I think most of the switching stuff that I use, like 27 material, things like that, they're typically just like 5 megahertz materials. There are some other materials that I'm aware of. The permeability drops considerably. In other words, the typical mu or permeability is like 2,500 for a switching power supply. Most of the permeability in the 300 megahertz area are probably, you know, at that point you start almost running up into like a distributed air gap almost type of material. So it gets a little strange when you're up there with ferrite and with the distributed air gaps in between, and they're kind of like have permeability less than 1,000.
Yeah, I think some of the really high frequency ferrites and powdered irons have permeabilities that are more like 10 and 20. My understanding is that the grain size has to get extremely small so you don't get any current losses, and yet you've got them bound together in this epoxy-like structure. So you're getting more and more air versus iron filings, I can call it, iron particles, and the iron particles have to get very small. So as the particles get smaller, the density of iron is getting lower and lower. Therefore, I think on the really high-frequency iron ferrite, I think we're talking about rather low numbers of mu's. I'll bet you it's more like 10 to 30. The question I was going to ask you, well, when it comes to frequencies like 300 megacycles, here's something I don't know. What's the difference between powdered iron and ferrite? Is there a difference? Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, absolutely. The heavier metal materials, your nickels, your powdered irons, being the more lossy, those materials are really used for storing energy, like inductors. If you're using voltage fed transformers where you don't want to store, you want to basic direct voltage coupling in the transformer, you want to stick more towards ferrite. Since it's happened, unfortunately, with the frequencies, the hysteresis losses are really what start biting you as you start getting into the higher frequency range, and that hysteresis curve starts getting wider and wider, turning to more loss. They do have, Thompson made some materials there for a while. There was an F1 material that was the 500 megahertz material for a while there, but the permeability was still pretty high, Dick. It was above 500, if I remember. Magnetic Sync had a K material that was still a voltage transformer up, you know, I've seen them used for signal transformer up to 1 gigahertz. Sometimes you find them at lower power levels being used in digital circuits, like in computer circuits for coupling digital signals in those types of areas where the output coupler is obviously, you know, there's nothing that fast in the output, so you have to do it magnetically.
Good to know. So, magnetic thing, K material, and Thompson has F1 material, 500 meg. Good sources of info. My friend Ken Kent was at a flea market, I think, where they were selling various kinds of ferrite, maybe powdered iron, and he was looking for a reference of which one of the ferrites can do his particular high-power 300 megacycle service. That's a tough one. I hear tell that you and Mel were talking power supplies for the wee hours of the morning at the Floyd Bennett Field. Is that true, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, kind of a half-truth. I wish I could have stayed there longer. I was able to stay there about an hour or so talking to Mel. I had an appointment at 7:30. I had to leave, but certainly had a lot of fun there. Very nice to meet Mel, and talking about a couple of things you know, I've done recently, and I think caught some of his interest with some of the work I had to do with power pack systems in the grid. And he was explaining to me some of the problems he had with adjusting the variacs and adjusting his line voltage through all the droops and the odd voltages that our power companies supply to us.
You mean to where I want?
Joe recognized. And before I go over to Joe, one quick question of you, Glenn. I wonder if you caught that PBS program talking about the green techniques being used in Germany, where they will pay you 50 cents a kilowatt hour for all of the renewable energy you pump back into their line, whether it be wind, photovoltaic, or whatever. And as more and more of our homes are going to have independent power sources, photovoltaic, wind, and so on,